This is a document. A big one. 450 pages. With a title matching the bulk.
Survey of the main trends of inquiry in the field of the natural sciences, the dissemination of scientific knowledge, and the application of such knowledge for peaceful ends.
The introduction begins with these words.
Scientific research has become so important in the 20th century that it is no longer possible to describe any human society, even in the broadest outline, without according it its rightful place.
For the moment, close the document. And open the program.
Science and the UN, a program from United Nations Radio on the links between modern research and technology and the work of the UN family of organizations for peace and human welfare.
The evolution of the human species, as Charles Darwin demonstrated, took a very long time. The evolution of human societies, on the other hand, has been relatively short, with inquisitive minds and practical hands setting the pace. From superstition to science, from the troglodyte's fire to the fusion of atoms, from the wings of Icarus to Gagarin and Titov, the speedometer of history has registered a steady acceleration. Until today.
Certains, pensant aux terribles menaces d'une guerre atomique, à la possibilité de suicide collectif ainsi apparu, songeant à la folie des hommes auxquels...
Some people, thinking of the frightful threat of atomic war and the possibility of collective suicide it conjures up, thinking also of the madness of man, to whom science has given such a power of destruction, have reached the stage of wishing to halt scientific advance and prohibit research.
The speaker, in an expression of the true spirit of science, rejects such a view. He is the French physicist Francis Perrin, president of the second UN conference on Atoms for Peace.
Arrêter la science, ce serait renoncer à éclaircir ce que nous devons encore appeler le mystère de la vie. Ce serait renoncer à vaincre définitivement...
To halt science would be to give up seeking to shed light on what we must still call the mystery of life. To give up attempting the final conquest of disease, old age, and death itself. No, we must have the courage or the wisdom to look the facts in the face. It is neither possible nor desirable to restore mankind to a youth which was so laborious, troubled, and lacking in pristine freshness.
Pour le meilleur et pour le pire, elle a uni sa destinée à celle de la science, à nous tous, de tout faire pour écarter le pire.
For better or worse, man has linked his destiny to that of science. It is up to us to do everything we can to avert the worst and to exalt the best. Those glorious conquests of the spirit, the dignity of man facing his destiny, trying to understand and to master it.
Thousand years ago, the best was exalted by a great king, Asoka. He ruled an empire which embraced the whole of southern Asia, from India to Indonesia. Disgusted by force, he solemnly and publicly renounced its use and devoted his life to the promotion of peace, to great public works for the welfare of his people. The name of Asoka's empire was Kalinga. Today, that name is attached to a prize awarded each year by UNESCO. Mr. René Mahieu, Assistant Director General of the organization, explains.
C'est sous cette invocation et selon le vœu de son fondateur, Monsieur Patnaik, a member of the Assembly.
It was the wish of the founder of the prize, Mr. Patnaik, a member of the Legislative Assembly of the Indian State of Orissa and one of the directors of the Kalinga Foundation, that it be awarded annually to a great scientific writer who has played an outstanding part in spreading scientific knowledge among the general public, and whose works shed light on the social implications of scientific progress.
This year, an international scientific jury of three from Italy, the Soviet Union, and the United States chose, as the winner of the Kalinga Prize, a British science writer and professor of international relations, Ritchie Calder. Here is part of his acknowledgement speech made at UNESCO headquarters in Paris.
The crisis of our times is the breakdown of communications, not just in the sense of political barriers, but in this all-important area of science. Our lives, our hopes, our survival depend on the uses which are made of science. To progress, we have to use scientific knowledge and discovery to its utmost advantage. Science in the advanced countries is developing so fast that it is almost impossible to keep pace with the knowledge and the gadgets which are aggregating. I believe that some 3 million original scientific papers a year are published. Wisdom is being drowned in a Niagara of information. The various branches of science are out of step. Cults of science are developed and encouraged by disproportionate budgets. Large areas of science are still enclosed in the compounds of military security. Others are segregated merely by over-specialization. But in either case, the fences are up. One set of scientists don't know what another set is doing, and yet there may be an important affinity which may be of material value to mankind.
Awareness of this problem, both inside and outside the UN family, is not something new. From the earliest years of their existence, the UN and many of its specialized agencies have been concerned with the development of international contact and exchange in the fields of science and technology. A mere glance at the names of these organizations, without going into the details of their work, is enough to indicate the size and the scope of the existing machinery.
UNESCO.
The United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization.
IAEA.
The International Atomic Energy Agency.
ITU.
The International Telecommunications Union.
WMO.
The World Meteorological Organization.
WHO.
The World Health Organization.
FAO.
The Food and Agriculture Organization.
And directly connected with the UN itself, such standing bodies as these:
the Scientific Advisory Committee, the Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation, and the Committee on Industrial Development.
Not to mention the almost continuous but temporary contacts made at major conferences and seminars, and in small technical working groups. But all this is not enough, a fact recognized at the UN General Assembly in 1958 in a resolution which gave birth to the 450-page survey mentioned at the start of this program.
Main trends of inquiry, dissemination of knowledge, etc., etc.
It was a first step. Individuals and scientific institutions in many countries contributed to it. It became a veritable encyclopedia of contemporary research. Just to glance through it is to appreciate the strength of the modern flood tide of information, which Ritchie Calder referred to a moment ago. To take the case of chemistry, for example, the survey points out that in the days of Lavoisier, it was a reasonably compact science. But chemists soon had to subdivide their work, first into the organic and inorganic branches. Later, this specialization spilled over into other sciences, such as physics. Until today, there's a whole series of new fields of research with double or even triple names: biochemistry, astrophysics, mathematical chemistry, physico-chemical biology, and so on. With this as the background, the survey concludes with some general observations and recommendations. This is one of them.
Many states have set up national institutions to coordinate or even to organize scientific research with the aim of ensuring the rapid progress of knowledge and its application. However, the very diversity of their respective arrangements makes it highly desirable that states should become better acquainted with one another's systems.
And this:
there is at present no agency in the United Nations family concentrating on the international aspects of technology, applied research, and industrial developments, as distinct from technical assistance in the strict sense of the term. The problem might be solved by establishing an appropriate service within the United Nations family itself, or a new organization which would concentrate on technological questions involved in the development of economic and geographical regions.
A suggestion which may or may not bear fruit in the future. Governments are frequently cautious in their reactions to such ideas. Sometimes, even when appropriate services, to borrow the survey's phrase, are established, they run into snags. At that same 58 assembly, for instance, the demands of the space age were producing their first response from the delegates. Speaking then, the late John Foster Dulles, then United States Secretary of State.
How shall outer space be used? That is of intense interest and importance to all mankind. We must make every effort to dedicate outer space exclusively to constructive pursuits.
And at the same time, the Soviet foreign minister, Andrei Gromyko.
Everything depends on what direction is given to the mastery of cosmic space, whether it is directed towards solving the problems of peaceful construction or serves the ends of destruction and war.
An identity of sentiment which resulted in the establishment of the UN Outer Space Committee. But this group was immediately hampered in its work by political differences between the Soviet Union and the United States over the matter of its composition, how many and which countries should be in it. Here, Mr. Valerian Zorin, speaking for the Soviet Union.
Вы включили ваш список 18 стран.
In your 18-country list, you have included 12, no less, which are members of military blocs and which are linked with you in such blocs. You have included 3 countries of the socialist camp and 3 neutral countries. Is this in keeping with the principles of the United Nations?
For the United States, which had proposed the 18 members, Mr. Henry Cabot Lodge.
The Soviet representative argued that the committee must meet the Soviet principle that there should be equality of representation between what he called the two sides. This two sides idea is a concept which the United States cannot accept. There are no two sides to outer space.
That was in 1958. During 59, the committee did meet, but without 5 of its members, the Soviet Union, Poland, and Czechoslovakia, and, because they felt little could be done without the Soviet Union, India, and the United Arab Republic. At the 59 assembly, the membership problem was solved. The committee was enlarged to 24. Despite this agreement, however, it has not so far met again. At the 1960 assembly, comments on this state of affairs were not lacking. Typical of many of them was this one, by Dr. Mehdi Vakil, head of the delegation of Iran.
Il est réconfortant de constater que, jusqu'à présent, aucun État n'a revendiqué une partie quelconque de l'espace.
It is heartening that as yet no state has claimed any part of outer space or demanded any privileged portion in that respect. However, the fact that nothing like this has yet happened does not necessarily mean that it is outside the realm of possibility. Unfortunately, the Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space has not met since the last session of the Assembly. At the committee's previous meeting, the absence of the Soviet Union delegation left a serious gap. The committee decided to proceed with caution in order to avoid endangering its subsequent activities. Nevertheless, the prospects of holding another session seem hardly encouraging for the moment. Here again, the initiative in negotiations on outer space can only come from the great powers. For its part, my government feels that the United Nations should not allow the formulation of space law to be indefinitely postponed.
Almost a year after those words were spoken in the General Assembly Hall, they were echoed 3,000 miles away at a meeting of the International Astronomical Union in California. 1,500 astronomers from every region and group in the world were welcomed by the leader of the United States delegation to the UN, Mr. Adlai Stevenson. And here is just one brief extract from his speech.
Surely all the world would breathe easier if the conquest of space were looked on henceforward not as a means to the power and the glory of particular nations or ideologies, but as one of the great adventures of the whole human race. technology will not wait long for an answer. In just a few years, there will be rocket boosters in more than one country, big enough to launch whole teams of men on journeys to the nearest planets. Shall this too, at huge and wasteful expense, be a race for military or psychological advantage? Or shall it be the occasion for teamwork, ignoring ideological lines? We haven't much time left in which to decide. It is a fork in the road, which soon must be passed.
We haven't much time. The same might be said of another, if less spectacular, link between the UN and science and technology. It is the link with the whole broad field of economic and social development, the UN's number two duty after the maintenance of peace. For the background here, UN Radio talked to someone with an intimate understanding of the situation, India's Minister for Scientific Research and Cultural Affairs, Mr. Humayun Kabir. Although he speaks in a nation context, his remarks apply equally well to the other underdeveloped regions of the world.
In Europe, the greatest progress has been made in the last 250 or 300 years, which all begin from the time of the Renaissance, and especially from the time of the first industrial revolution, which was itself a direct result of the advances in scientific knowledge. And the changes which have taken place in Europe and America have been mainly the result of progressive application of science and technology to more and more spheres of life.
But in Asia?
So far as Asia is concerned, I think it would be correct to say that for a very long time, science and technology have not made that impact. Of course, science and technology had their beginnings in Asia. And some of the greatest scientists in ancient times were Asians. But somehow something happened. And the result was that the Asiatic mind, the mind of the Asian people, it did not go along the lines of science and technology. And especially for the last 300 or 400 years, on the whole, Asian society has been static and moribund because it was a recipient of the impact of science rather than an active participant. It did not initiate changes, but it received the result of changes initiated elsewhere.
But this pattern itself is now changing. The Asian Renaissance, the Renaissance of all the underdeveloped parts of the world, is well underway. Politically, the change is virtually complete, as the list of sovereign states, now members of the UN, vividly illustrates. Technically and scientifically, much still remains to be done. When he accepted the Kalinga Prize, Ritchie Calder underlined the needs by asking some questions.
How much more resources and attention should we be giving to problems of this planet, on which 4,000 million people will have to contrive to live 20 years from now? Is space adventure more important than food and population problems, for instance? What I am posing is not a conflict of choices, but or setting one against another, but deciding how much. And how, with all the spectacular advances of today, can we close the widening gap between the prosperity of the scientifically advanced countries and the poverty of the impoverished ones?
The temptation is to answer by saying, introduce the spectacular advances wherever they're needed. Automate and mechanize. Bring on the new ideas and the latest techniques, and do so with the speed of the spectacular advances themselves. Unfortunately, it's not as easy as all that, and views differ on how to approach the problem. Some authorities believe that science is no magic wand which, in one wave, can convert poverty into plenty. For example, Professor P.M.S. Blackett of the Imperial College of Science and Technology in London has written this.
There is already far more technology, know-how, and material goods, particularly production goods, than any but the richest country can afford to utilize. When the emergent countries go shopping in this world supermarket for technical know-how and production and consumption goods, they must compile a shopping list with a rational choice of priorities.
But what is a rational list? What should come first? The biological and agricultural sciences to improve the quality of animals and plants, or technical surveys of natural resources? And what about all the know-how needed for industrial development? Earlier this year, the United Nations Committee for Industrialization held its first meeting. In the course of it, the representative of the Soviet Union, Mr. Vasily Sergeyev, made this observation.
Советская делегация убеждена, что быстрое промышленное развитие
The Soviet Union is convinced that industrial development is impossible without the active participation of the state. Economists of the Western countries have, in recent years, relied on the theory that the creation of an economic infrastructure and the development of trained personnel must necessarily precede the industrialization process. That is a completely false contention and an attempt to delay the industrialization of the less developed countries indefinitely.
For another view, a quote from a recent article by Professor Arthur Lewis, principal of the University College of the West Indies, who for a time was associated with the work of the UN Special Fund.
The sciences upon which the various branches of engineering depend may prove to be a menace rather than a help to the new states. In the developed countries, one of the chief purposes of applying science to production is to find ways of doing by machine what was previously done by hand. Such technology is very appropriate to countries where labor is scarce and expensive relative to capital. But it is irrelevant to most underdeveloped areas, where the problem is to devise new technologies which will make manpower much more efficient without much capital.
A view which recalls that first meeting of the Committee for Industrialization and a speech made there by the UN Undersecretary for Economic and Social Affairs, Mr. Philippe de Senne. He spoke in French, but here is the official translation.
On the whole, it can be said that the role of science and technology in the evolution of the underdeveloped countries is still not fully explored. Numerous activities are being carried on, particularly under the auspices of the United Nations and the specialized agencies, but unfortunately, no attempt has yet been made to obtain an overall view of these activities and subject them to critical examination. If that was done, it would be easier to determine the most favorable conditions for the transfer and adaptation of technology, as well as the fields in which new and specialized research is needed.
That meeting of the Industrialization Committee was held in March. Since then, there have been two developments which indicate that a more determined attempt is now being made to explore the field. The first was the UN Conference on New Sources of Energy held in Rome during August. This was a meeting of scientists and engineers working on the many possible applications of energy from the sun, the wind, and the heat stored within the earth. Their contributions were too numerous and complex to summarize adequately here. But without minimizing the many difficulties which have still to be overcome, three authorities can be quoted to indicate the great potential of these new sources. Take first, geothermal energy.
John H. Smith, a geothermal engineer in New Zealand, a country already exploiting this source, delivered a paper on its potential for generating electricity. His conclusion was that the amount of geothermal energy available throughout the world is probably enormous, and that many conveniently located areas can be successfully developed. And geothermal power plants already working have demonstrated the possibility of producing power at very low cost.
Now, the wind.
German expert Dr. Ulrich Hütter, in a paper on recent developments and possible improvement in the use of wind power, concluded that there is no need for renewed proof that, in conditions that are often found in underdeveloped countries, its use is technically feasible and economically justified.
And now, the sun.
Dr. John Duffy, director of the Solar Energy Laboratory at the University of Wisconsin in the United States, discussed new materials which are now becoming available in his field, such as plastics for solar batteries. These, he said, are of immediate and potential importance in reducing the cost of using solar energy. He cited research in many countries which indicates significant progress towards the practical and economical use of the sun's rays.
Practical rather than theoretical. That was the emphasis of the meeting. As one of the participants, Dr. Henry Tabor of Israel's National Physical Laboratory said,
I'm sure that in many parts of the world, the whole life of the village could be revolutionized could certainly be improved enormously, and the whole level of living of the community could be raised if local source of power was available. And in most cases, these people just have no fuel at all and therefore have never considered the use of mechanical power.
So the Rome Conference was organized to focus attention on the possibilities of using these natural but neglected sources of power in areas which lack more conventional and sometimes costly sources. The second development stems from a recommendation by the UN Scientific Advisory Committee, composed of prominent scientists from Brazil, Canada, France, India, the Soviet Union, the United Kingdom, and the United States. In a report issued last May, they suggested that during 1962, a major international conference should be held to examine how science and technology can help to accelerate economic development. In particular, said the scientists, the conference should emphasize six main themes.
How the human raw material and energy resources of the less developed countries can be put to better use.
How industrial development can be speeded up by using the latest achievements in science and engineering, particularly in machines and machine tools.
How agriculture can be improved by using the latest techniques in irrigation, land improvement, and mechanization.
How scientists, engineers, scientific teachers, and technicians can best be trained in the underdeveloped countries.
How scientific research can best be organized in these countries, with particular attention being given to the problems and possibilities of cooperative research between groups of countries.
And finally,
how science and technology can contribute to the improvement of public health.
On August 3rd, the Economic and Social Council meeting in Geneva decided unanimously that this proposed conference should be held. The date for it was set tentatively for next August. Governments are now considering the provisional agenda. Their observations may add to or subtract from it. The detailed organization of the meeting is underway. Thus, another link has been forged between science, technology, and the work of the UN family towards the objectives of the Charter: better standards of life in larger freedom. It is not the first of such links, nor will it be the last. It is simply one demonstration among many of the truth of Professor Perrin's words.
Pour le meilleur et pour le pire, elle a uni sa destinée à celle de la science. À nous tous de tout faire pour écarter le pire.
For better or worse, man has linked his destiny to that of science. It is up to us to do everything we can to avert the worst and to exalt the best. Those glorious conquests of the spirit, the dignity of man facing his destiny, trying to understand and to master it.
You have been listening to Science and the UN, a program illustrating the many existing and potential links between the World Organization and its agencies and modern research and technology. The program was produced by the international staff of United Nations Radio.